Imagine discovering that, I don't know, the absolute unbreakable laws of your reality, the things you consider to be like foundational facts of existence, like gravity or the passage of time, were actually just the result of a teenager's moving anxiety in a completely different universe.
Right, which is just a wild concept to wrap your head around.
It really is. And today we are looking at a story that asks a pretty profound question. If our reality is just a story someone else wrote, well, how do we go about rewriting it? Welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive. We are super thrilled to have you with us today.
We definitely are.
Our mission today is to unpack this really fascinating narrative log set in the fantasy world of Mirari. We're going to examine the immense psychological weight carried by the protagonist, Thomas, and explore this mind-bending revelation about how this magical world secretly connects to a totally mundane mortal realm.
And it is a remarkable narrative because it
Yeah.
completely subverts what we expect from, high fantasy. The true core of this story isn't the sword fights or the magic systems.
Yeah.
It is the struggle against psychological manipulation. It's this deep exploration of how our traumas haunt us and how battles are really won or lost in the mind long before a sword is ever drawn.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this because the opening is just incredibly visceral. You are camping in a freezing, snowy forest. You've cleared the ground, you've pitched the tents, and layered yourself in thick cloth and downy blankets just to, survive the bitter chill.
Just trying not to freeze to death.
Yeah, exactly. And you are just drifting off to sleep right on that edge of rest, only to be jolted awake by the shrieks of this bizarre aerial battle. You stumble outside into the biting wind, and above you, illuminated by the moonlight, a messenger hawk is fighting for its life against a skull-headed crow.
And this imagery does some really heavy lifting right out of the gate. I mean, a skull-headed crow is deeply unsettling on its own.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
But it also immediately establishes a theme of surveillance and, well, death. We're not in a safe place, and the characters are being watched by an antagonist who actively perverts nature to keep tabs on them.
So Thomas, our protagonist, steps out of his tent alongside a young knight named Sir Lefalon and a fey woman named Rachel. Thomas sees this crow, which is a minion of the main villain, a figure known as Jack, or the Destroyer, and he doesn't even hesitate.
Now for a second.
He just strikes the crow with his silvery blade, and it literally shatters into a collection of dry, rattling, yellowed bones and feathers. It is such a sudden burst of violence in this quiet, freezing camp.
It has to be sudden, though. Thomas knows the stakes of being hunted. He absolutely cannot allow this creature to report his location. But the irony here is that by destroying the physical threat, he opens the door to the psychological one.
Oh, totally.
Because the hawk survives and delivers its message, which sets the entire psychological trap in motion.
Right, so the hawk lands, digging its claws into Thomas's cloth-wrapped arm. It carries this white disc with a stylized gold N on it, and touching it projects a holographic message. First, it's a friend named Agatha warning him not to go to their destination, which is the Icejaw Pit alone.
Which is a pretty dire warning.
Yeah. Then the image shifts to a sorceress named Nimue. She delivers what might be the thesis statement of the whole story. She explicitly warns Thomas that the Destroyer's greatest weapon isn't his magic or his armies, but the divisiveness of his foes. She begs Thomas not to repeat the past by pushing his friends away.
Nimue is identifying the exact mechanics of how the Destroyer actually operates. He doesn't just overpower people, he isolates them.
Right.
He finds the hairline fractures in their relationships or, their own self-worth, and he applies pressure until they break apart voluntarily.
And the Destroyer doesn't wait a single second to prove her right. Almost immediately after this warning, a silhouette appears against the camp's firelight, but the light is shining through the figure. It's a translucent
Which
ghost.
is just jarring after that warning.
And not just any ghost, it's Randall, Thomas's old friend. Randall claims he died fighting trolls, that his soul can't rest, and that he found a secret path into the Destroyer's keep past a sleeping iron dragon named Monitor.
And that's when he drops the hook.
Exactly. He begs Thomas to come bury his body so he can find peace, but he insists Thomas must come alone. He claims bringing his friends, who are clumsy and loud, will wake the dragon.
What's fascinating here is the precision of this manipulation. The Destroyer is weaponizing Thomas's guilt. The Destroyer knows Thomas's fatal flaw is his noble streak, his willingness to sacrifice himself to spare his friends.
Right, he literally targets his best qualities.
Exactly. Thomas actually admits this later. The villain isn't attacking Thomas's weaknesses, he is attacking his virtues.
It's basically a targeted emotional algorithm. It's like getting a text from an old friend asking for desperate help, but the text is actually a homing missile of emotional trauma designed to isolate you.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Randall plays all the hits. He says, "I sacrificed myself for the greater good. You set the example for me. We held you back last time because we were afraid." It's this overwhelming barrage of everything Thomas feels guilty about, perfectly calibrated to separate him from Sir LaFallon and Rachel.
And if we look at the physical mechanics of this encounter, they are terrifying. Randall fakes a struggle, claiming the destroyer is trying to drag his spirit away right in that exact moment.
Oh, creating that false urgency.
Yes. Manipulators always use urgency to prevent you from thinking critically. So Randall reaches a hand out to Thomas, begging for help.
And Thomas is completely torn. I mean, he wants to save his friends, so he reaches back. But the moment their hands touch, the illusion cracks. Thomas feels that the ghost's hand is physically solid.
Which shouldn't be possible.
Right. A translucent spirit shouldn't have physical mass. And when Thomas looks closer into Randall's eyes through the dark pupils, he sees it. There is a faint but unmistakable skull in the darkness.
That physical solidity is the crucial tell. In this universe, magical rules actually matter. The destroyer can manipulate perception, but he couldn't completely erase the physical reality of what he had created. Randall is not a ghost seeking peace. He is a wraith. He's a physical corpse already enslaved and animated by the destroyer.
Which is just so dark. It immediately turns into a tragic fight. Thomas yells for LaFallon to draw his sword. Thomas is pleading with this wraith to fight the mind control, but the wraith just whispers, "Kill me now," before launching a lethal strike at Thomas's eyes.
It's brutal.
Thomas forces the wraith's blade into the ground, and LaFallon lunges forward, impaling it. Black ichor puddles in the snow, and the wraith literally salutes Thomas, promising they'll meet again, and fades into nothing. Thomas just collapses. He leans heavily on his sword, weeping, and promises to hunt the destroyer until the end of time.
He survived the physical ambush, sure, but the emotional toll is just devastating. The destroyer achieved his goal of inflicting profound psychological damage. But, you know, this extreme emotional manipulation forces a breaking point.
Yeah, it really does.
It completely strips away Thomas's defenses, leading him to reveal a secret to Rachel that fundamentally changes the architecture of the whole story.
Because if the destroyer is this powerful at manipulating the rules of reality with illusions and wraiths, it begs the question, who wrote the rules of this reality in the first place? And this brings us to the massive lore bomb Thomas drops. Rachel is horrified by what just happened and starts questioning the nature of the destroyer.
Naturally.
Thomas reveals the destroyer's real name is John Harcourt. And then he explains that the entire world of Mirari is inextricably tied to the mortal realm.
This is where the narrative shifts from a standard fantasy adventure into a deeply philosophical meta-narrative. Up until this point, we and Rachel assume Mirari operates on ancient, intrinsic magic. But Thomas reveals that the foundational laws of this world are actually derived from mundane events in a completely different universe.
Wait, hold on. Let me make sure we're really unpacking the scale of this, because I was blown away when I read this. Thomas explains something called the rule of a year. In Mirari, a king only rules for one single year. Rachel believes this is an ancient, unquestionable, magical decree from the gods.
Right, a sacred law.
But Thomas says no. It exists simply because King Riordan, who was actually just a mortal boy named Ryan Jordan, had to move away from his home in a place called Anakton after exactly 1 year. Are we seriously saying that the geopolitical structures and magical decrees of this entire universe are just side effects of a mortal family hiring moving trucks?
We are. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is a brilliant commentary on how real-world mythology is formed. The Fae of Mirari observed the mortal realm. They wanted to tap into the power of these mortals, but they didn't understand the context of what they were observing.
So they just filled in the blanks.
Exactly. So a teenager moving away after a year is stripped of its mundane context, the moving trucks, the parents' new jobs, and that isolated event is calcified into an absolute sacred law.
That is wild. Rachel is absolutely stunned, and honestly, so was I. She argues back, saying, the rule of a year has always been true. That can't be something invented by your mortal grandmother, referring to another lore figure, Lady Chiris of House February. She is experiencing pure existential dread.
And rightfully so. I mean, discovering that your reality, your deepest traditions, and the laws governing your life were essentially invented by someone's mortal grandmother is terrifying. It means the ground beneath your feet isn't solid. It means the universe is arbitrary.
She realizes that the magical artifacts they carry hold power simply because the people of Mirari wanted them to hold power. They believed in the mortal connection, and that belief generated the magic. It completely flips the script. The universe isn't dictating the rules to them. Their collective belief is dictating the rules to the universe.
This is an incredibly empowering realization once you get past that initial dread. Thomas takes this terrifying concept and turns it into a weapon.
Yeah, he uses it.
If the world is shaped by the beliefs and actions of the mortal realm and sustained by the belief of the Fae, then belief itself is the ultimate magic. If they collectively believe they cannot change the world, they are trapped. But if they actively, consciously choose to believe they can alter reality, they might actually be able to do it.
If the architecture of your reality is just a story someone else wrote based on a misunderstanding, you can just write a new story. But how do you actually test a hypothesis like that?
You have to try something big.
Right. You have to try to manifest something impossible. So Thomas, Rachel, and the Felon decide to hack reality. They are facing this harsh, freezing journey to the ice jaw pit. Instead of accepting the grim reality of the empty snow, they collaboratively start believing a new environment into existence.
Which is such a cool concept.
They decide that halfway to their destination, there isn't just empty snow. They decree that there is a warm, bustling trading post. And they get specific. It's not on their maps because it was founded exactly 12 years ago by their old friend, the wise woman Oberia.
Notice how they do this too. They don't just say, I wish there was a house. Mm. They are actively constructing a localized reality by pooling their shared intent and backdating it. They give it a history 12 years ago, and they anchor it to a specific person they already trust. They are essentially coding a new reality using incredibly specific parameters.
But I have to challenge this logic, and I'm sure you listening might be wondering this too. If you realize you have developer access to the universe and can hack reality with belief, why on earth would you start with a trading post? Rachel even jokes about this. She says she wants to end the winter, or she wants the destroyer to never have existed. Why not just believe the bad guy doesn't exist anymore and roll the credits?
It's the logical question to ask, and the text actually provides a deeply psychological answer.
Yeah.
Rachel points out that it is infinitely easier to believe in something if you don't already know what the truth is.
Oh, that makes sense.
You cannot just wish away a deeply entrenched, universally accepted trauma like the destroyer. His existence is too heavily reinforced by the collective fear of everyone in Mirari. It's like trying to pretend a mountain isn't in front of you.
Right.
But the unknown, the blank spaces on the map, those are malleable. You can build a safe haven in the margins because there is no pre-existing contradictory truth fighting against your belief.
That makes perfect sense. You can build a house in an empty field, but you can't just delete a skyscraper with your mind. You have to walk before you run. So while they are trekking through the snow, attempting this philosophical magic trick, the source material gives us a brilliant contrast. It cuts to a parallel timeline showing what is happening to their allies, Agatha and Hannah, who are racing to meet them.
And this contrast is vital because it reminds us that the existing dangerous reality of Mirari is still very much active.
Exactly. Agatha and Hannah aren't doing philosophical metamagic. They are experiencing the raw, kinetic power of the world. They are riding night steeds. Agatha is riding this massive, telepathic white stallion named a Hearn, and the source describes this feeling so vividly.
Oh, the motorcycle comparison.
Yes. It says riding a Hearn is like upgrading from a tricycle to a Harley Davidson. You don't just sit on him, you lean over his neck, streamline yourself, and mentally become part of the animal. They are flying over the snow, completely unstoppable.
It's a rush of pure physical magic, but kinetic power is loud, and in a hostile world, being loud attracts attention.
Which they find out the hard way. They arrive at the ruined village of Kirabanuak, hoping to take shelter in an old watchtower. They notice large, misshapen tracks in the snow, and as they ride past these abandoned two-story cottages, it's a trap. Ropey, green-gray trolls literally hurl themselves out of the second-story windows, howling and ambushing them from above.
It is a brutal reminder that regardless of the reality Thomas and Rachel are trying to manifest miles away, the established reality of the Destroyer's forces is violently entrenched.
And what's fascinating is how the narrative layers time here. It quickly pivots back to Thomas's earlier stop at that exact same ruined village of Kirabanuak before Agatha got there and got ambushed. When Thomas was there, he met the former lord of the area, a vagabond named Pelis, and his companion, Bragwain.
We really have to talk about Bragwain.
We absolutely do, because Bragwain is a talking Siamese cat wearing a two-fish pendant who spends the scene poking her head out of Pelis's tattered rags. Amidst all this heavy psychological trauma, existential dread, and troll ambushes, you have a cross-eyed cat giving life advice.
It might seem jarring at first, but it serves a very specific structural purpose. It highlights the absurdity that inherently exists in mythological narratives. If your reality is based on the misunderstood imaginations of mortals, it's going to be a little weird sometimes.
Yeah, that tracks.
Furthermore, it lowers the listener's defenses right before delivering a crucial piece of lore.
Which Pelis delivers. He gives a very sobering warning about the Grail, the artifact that Sir Lefalon is carrying. Pelis warns them that the Grail is neither a panacea to cure all ills, nor is it a weapon to strike down enemies. And ominously, he says that once it is returned to where it belongs, it won't be easily found again.
This is an important tempering of expectations. Thomas is learning he can rewrite reality, but Pelis is reminding him that ancient artifacts still operate on their own complex, restrictive logic. There are no easy fix-all buttons in this world.
Thomas just accepts this cryptic warning. He writes a note for Agatha to find later, which, unfortunately, doesn't stop her from getting ambushed by trolls, and he leaves the note with the cat. There is this hilarious, surreal image of Bragwaine the cat taking the letter in her mouth and cheerfully shouting, "Good luck, God bless, and don't get killed," as they ride off into deadly peril.
It's a moment of levity before the final test of their manifestation theory.
Right. So leaving the ruins and the talking cat behind, Thomas, Rachel, and Lefalon ride west into the barren, snowy lands of Anne. They are going to see if their hacked reality actually spawned. And it worked. They crest a hill, and instead of endless snow, they find Kersidi.
They successfully altered the landscape. They overwrote the local code of the universe.
And the sensory details the source provides are incredible. It is a vivid desert bazaar rising out of nowhere. The sky above it is pale violet. There are sloped roofs covered in shiny hammered metal and mirrors everywhere reflecting the intense light. It's bustling, noisy, and chaotic.
Just a totally different environment.
Exactly. Merchants are screaming about water prices. One guy is shouting, "Cheapest water, only one silver a bag." It is a complete sensory overload compared to the dead, freezing plains they were just walking through.
But here is where we see the catch. This raises an important question, right?
Right.
It's a brilliant nuance in the mechanics of their magic. They successfully manifested a safe haven. However, they are fundamentally warriors and survivors.
Yeah.
Their entire worldview has been shaped by being hunted by the destroyer.
Right.
They inherently understand that trade towns attract skies. They know danger is always lurking. Because they cannot subconsciously conceive of a reality without danger, they accidentally code that danger into their manifestation.
Wow. If you write the code for a trading post, but your internal operating system is paranoia, you automatically spawn enemies. And we see it instantly. Almost the second they walk into the crowd, Thomas locks eyes with a mysterious black-robed man watching him from the shadows. The destroyer spies are already there in a town Thomas and Rachel literally just created.
They cannot escape the logic of their own trauma. They changed the set dressing, but they couldn't change their internal script fast enough to keep the threat out.
But they push through the bazaar anyway. They buy some blue silk from a merchant who gives them incredibly elaborate directions, and finally they find her. Sitting by a dry well in a plaza is wise woman Oberia. She's telling a group of children a ghost story about a man cursed by a water conjurer to never drink water again.
It's a very somber, grounded image. Even in a manifested reality, life goes on. She is passing down cautionary tales to the next generation, perpetuating the cycle of mythology and belief.
The reunion itself is touching, but really heavy. Oberia has aged significantly. The text notes her once ruddy gold hair is now short and gray. She recognizes Thomas instantly. He looks exactly the same as he did 14 years ago. She asks where his army is this time. And Lefalon, providing some much-needed banter, quips that Thomas would just run off and leave an army behind anyway, so there's no point bringing one.
Which shows that even in this artificially constructed reality, the core dynamics and histories of their friendships remain authentic. The world might be malleable, but their connections are real.
But then Thomas asks the heavy question, what brought you to such a desolate, difficult place? Why are you here in this desert? And the source leaves us on a heartbreaking cliffhanger. Oberia drops her gaze and simply says, Randall did. She invites them inside her home to escape the spies watching them in the plaza, and the narrative just cuts off.
And it all circles back to the trauma. They built a haven from their own hopeful belief. But the foundational anchor of that haven is the ghost of their past failures. Randall is the reason O'Berry is there, just as Randall's wraith was the catalyst for Thomas pushing his understanding of reality to the breaking point. The trauma is inescapable, even when you write the rules yourself.
So what does this all mean? Let's synthesize all of this, because we've covered massive ground today. We started with Thomas battling the literal weaponized ghost of his old friend, a perfect metaphor for how manipulators use our own guilt against us. We moved to the mind-bending realization that the absolute magical laws of their universe were just mundane family events from a mortal realm, stripped of context and calcified by belief. And we ended with our heroes literally speaking a desert trading post into existence, only to realize that their own subconscious fears manifested the villains right alongside them.
The overarching takeaway from this narrative log is that the true battle isn't against the ropey trolls jumping out of windows or the wraiths in the snow. It is a battle for the narrative of reality itself. The Destroyer uses illusions, guilt, and trauma to enforce a reality of fear, isolation, and division. Thomas and Rachel realize that to fight back, swords aren't enough. They must use hope, conscious belief, and shared intent to write a new reality. It is a war of perception, and it requires constant active participation to keep the dark out.
And that is exactly the thought I want to leave you with today. In the story, Thomas and Rachel literally spoke a safe haven into existence because they chose to believe in it, specifically in the empty, undefined spaces of their map. But think about your own life. Think about the rules you operate under every day.
It's a great exercise.
How many of the absolute rules you live by, the things you think are impossible, the limitations you place on your career or your relationships, the traditions you unquestioningly follow are just outdated scripts? How many of them were written by someone else's mundane circumstances years ago and you just accepted them as laws of nature? If the architecture of your reality is built on stories you've been told, what happens if you decide to tell a different one?
It requires immense courage to look at a limitation and decide it is just a suggestion. But as the story shows, if you change the belief, you can change the world.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep questioning the world around you, and most importantly, keep an eye on the stories you are telling yourself. We will catch you next time.